Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Sensation Center Collaborative Conference Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Wes. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's call, Population Level Strategies to Prevent and Reduce Tobacco Use, Success and Challenge. You may view today's presentation in one of two ways, as a webinar or by downloading the slides posted on the New York State Smokers Quit Line website. Links to the slides and webinar are posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit Line website, nysmokefree.com. To access today's presentation, go to nysmokefree.com. On the left-hand side of the website's homepage, there is a newsfeed section. Directly under the heading is an announcement for today's call. Click on the link provided, and it will bring you to the page for today's webinar. On the same page under Tools, you will also find a list of the New York State Cessation Centers with their respective service areas. The Cessation Center staff are available to assist your organization with developing and implementing tobacco dependence treatment policies and clinical protocols. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Harlan Juster, Director of the Bureau of Tobacco Control, who administers New York State's Comprehensive Tobacco Control Program, which is comprised of local and statewide contractors, health communications, the New York State Smokers Quit Line, and a robust independent evaluation. Dr. Juster has been with the Department of Health and the Bureau of Tobacco Control since 2000. His previous role in the Bureau was as manager of the Tobacco Surveillance Evaluation and Research Team. On today's call, Dr. Juster will discuss the best practices for broad-based youth prevention and the promotion of aggressive tobacco use treatment in the healthcare setting. He'll also provide a current and historical view of adult and youth tobacco use in New York State, focusing on the promise of generational change. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASIS continuing education credits to today's listeners. To fulfill the requirement of continuing education credits, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Juster has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to his presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms posted on the website. In addition, at the end of the webinar, you can complete the form online if you prefer. I'll provide links to the online and paper forms in the webinar chat box, and they are also posted on the Quitline site. Please remember applications for credit will not be accepted after November 13th. That is 1 week from today. So please be sure to submit your application as soon as possible to receive credit. For those who are viewing this presentation as a webinar, please note that if you do move to a different web page or multitask, you may be kicked off of the webinar, and you'll just have to log back on to join the webinar again. At this time, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Juster. Harlan?
Thanks, Anne. And just to do a quick sound check, you can hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to the collaborative to speak about tobacco control in New York State. I understand that some people are on the webinar will see the slides move, and other people will have a PDF, so I will try to keep you informed about where I am in the presentation. Let's go to the second slide and talk about the learning objectives a bit that Anne reviewed already. Best practices for preventing youth initiation and promoting smoking among adult smokers. I'll review some data showing progress and remaining challenges on both of those fronts. I'll discuss a couple of emerging smoking-related products that seem very attractive to youth and young adults in New York and elsewhere. And I'll discuss the components of what I like to think of as aggressive tobacco dependence treatment. So on the third slide, Just some background information and some general chronic disease information that we have here in New York. The Bureau of Tobacco Control is organizationally within the Division of Chronic Disease Prevention at the New York State Health Department. Besides tobacco control, the division focuses on cancer services, obesity prevention, and programs for preventing cardiovascular disease, diabetes, asthma, and arthritis. More than 40% of New Yorkers, that's over 7 million people, suffer from one of these chronic diseases. These diseases are slow in progression, long in duration, and often require medical attention, and are a major contributor to healthcare costs in New York and really everywhere else. But effective interventions do exist to prevent, reduce, or delay much of the burden of chronic disease. Next slide. Chronic diseases are responsible for 60% of deaths in New York State and nearly 1 in 4 hospitalizations. And on the next slide, going into this a bit further, of all deaths due to chronic disease in New York, heart disease and cancer account for over half of these. And on hospitalization slide, heart disease and cancer contribute to about 12% of all hospitalizations in New York State. So on the whole, chronic disease takes an enormous toll in lives, quality of life, and economics. And when we look at vulnerable populations, the rates of chronic disease and mortality are even higher. Things like socioeconomic status, gender, age, disability, language, geographic location, race, ethnicity, and other factors are all associated with higher rates of chronic disease and mortality. As I said, chronic disease can be prevented, delayed, or better managed. The CDC estimates that eliminating the 3 risk factors of smoking, unhealthy eating, and physical inactivity would prevent 80% of heart disease and stroke, 80% of type 2 diabetes, and 40% of cancer. And even modest reductions in the rates of one or more of these risk factors can have a large public health impact on the burden of chronic disease. So that brings us to our discussion of tobacco control in New York State. A little bit about the program. The Tobacco Control Program in New York State was established in 1999 following the Master Settlement Agreement between 46 states' attorneys general and the 4 largest tobacco companies. And this settlement brought to all the states about $225 billion, for a period of about 25 years. But the agreement goes in perpetuity, and new figures will be determined at that time. And this is, of course, to cover the costs of all the chronic disease that tobacco has caused the states to pay for. The program structure is organized around CDC's best practices and consists of the components listed here. Community action, I like to think of this as the local voice of the program. These contractors educate community members community leaders about the continuing burden of tobacco use and potential policy solutions that exist. Our health systems interventions work to ensure that evidence-based care for tobacco dependents is being provided, and that evidence-based treatments are widely available. And, of course, more on what that means a little bit later. The New York State Smokers Quit Line is really our only direct service providing free counseling and free NRT to smokers in New York in an easy-to-access format. Just call 1-866-NY-QUITS. Having the Quit Line also helps us to justify some of the strong media that we air, which brings me to the next component, which is health communications. This includes both paid and earned media. Paid media includes ads on television, outdoors, urban transportation, and now we're beginning to experiment and with digital communications to find the best way to reach our audience. And we try to reach them with emotionally evocative and graphic ads that accurately depict the negative consequences of tobacco use, and I'm sure you are familiar with some of those. We know through extensive evaluation that these ads work because they are associated with increases in quit attempts, calls to the quit line, and lower initiation rates among youth. And finally, a robust evaluation is required. It's an important part of our comprehensive program. Data from the evaluation are fed back to the program and used to improve our outcomes. We use it to select the most effective ads, to test and improve our messaging, and to ensure that we're reaching our audience and that attitudes are changing. The program focus slide. The tobacco control program has a strong population emphasis. It follows a policy and systems change approach that leads to environmental and social norm change. The goal is to create an environment in which tobacco use is not desired, not accepted, and not easily accessible. A sampling of some of the successes of tobacco control in New York over the last decade includes the 2003 expansion of the Clean Indoor Air Act, which restricted smoking in all restaurants, bars, and other work locations across the state. New York currently has the highest excise tax on cigarettes in the nation, and New York has generous Medicaid coverage for tobacco dependence treatment. We also have a decently funded, I'll change well-funded to decently funded tobacco control program. This allows us to have a strong presence in the media, in the community, and, of course, our evaluation is important to maintain funding for the program. Looking ahead, our policy initiatives that we are working on include reducing the impact of retail marketing on youth initiation and adult smoking, reducing exposure to secondhand smoke in multi-unit housing environments, especially those serving low socioeconomic status groups, and increasing tobacco-free outdoor policies, making parks and playgrounds tobacco-free environments. We will talk a little later about creating a health system environment in which every smoker receives aggressive tobacco dependence treatment, also one of our priorities. Key trends in tobacco control, next slide. What has been accomplished? Well, a lot, and let's just take a couple of minutes to look at that. The rates of adult smoking in New York State are down nearly 28% between 2000 and 2010, and in the last 4 years alone, they're down 23%, adult smoking rates. And there's two different lines there because there are two different methods of measuring adult rates, and I just put both on the same slide. High school age youth smoking rates are down nearly 60% between 2000 and 2012. Here the rate in 2000 was 27% of youth had tried a cigarette in the last month. In 2012, that was down to 12%. That's a very significant change. I don't have middle school age youth on the same graph, but they show a very similar trend. They're down nearly 70% in their use of tobacco. Cigarettes, actually. Next slide shows adult smoking prevalence by age group, and we don't have to focus on this too much. I just want to briefly point out one component of this chart. This is four different years, 2000, 2005, 2010, and 2012, adult smoking by different age groups. And the far left bar, the blue bar in each group, is the 18 to 24-year-old, the young adult age group. And that's really what I'm focusing on. And what you see is that early in the decade, they were the age group with the highest smoking rate, 33% in 2000, almost 27% in 2005. And that's a pattern that actually held in all the middle years, too, 2001, 2002, et cetera, that young adults were the age group with the highest smoking rates. That has changed. If you look at 2010 and 2012, and 2011 is the same, they are no longer the age group with the highest smoking rate. It's the next level up. It's the 25 to 34-year-olds. And why is this happening? Well, it's happening because of the previous slide. Youth are no longer showing the same level of interest in experimenting with tobacco, with trying tobacco, and they're much less likely to become young adult smokers. And so this is what I'm calling generational change. We're starting to see a social norm change, an environmental change, in which young people are just showing very little interest in tobacco. Once they get past 18 to 24-year-old, they will never be smokers. We know that 99% of smokers start before the age of 26, and almost 90% of them before the age of 18. So if we can prevent and continue to prevent initiation of smoking, we will see these graphs continually come down as the young groups, younger folks age up. And that's a very promising outcome that we're very excited about. Next slide shows that even those continuing to smoke are doing better by smoking less each day. So that in 2003, daily smokers averaged about 15 cigarettes per day. That's about 3/4 of a pack of cigarettes. In 2011, that number was down to just about 10 cigarettes per day, or about half a pack. That's almost a 33% reduction in daily consumption. Part of that is probably driven by our high excise taxes, but I'm assuming that other things are driving that as well, like all the media that we put out. I'm just getting a couple of questions about the lack of sound. I'm hoping people are hearing me. Can I just confirm that with you, Ann?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, then I'm going to keep going. So we are even starting to achieve some of our long-term objectives, which I didn't expect to be talking about so early on. These are changes in health outcomes. So this slide, it says observed and predicted admissions for AMI, for heart attacks. This one, hold on a second.
Occasionally, people don't realize that they have to also phone in addition to talking to the webinar.
Okay. If you can't hear, if you can't hear, I can't tell them. So the question was that make sure people are calling in separately on the phone line as opposed to going through the webinar. I'll just keep on moving here. So anyway, this slide shows that as a function of our clean indoor air law that was expanded in 2003, hospitalizations for heart attack were reduced, and I can tell you they were reduced about 5% per year following the Clean Indoor Air Act. And the next slide shows, this is from a recent report on tobacco-related cancers in New York. This graph shows that lung cancer rates in New York City peaked in about 1992 and have begun to decline. In the rest of the state outside of New York City, it's happening a little bit later, but that decline does appear to be starting as well. The Tobacco Control Program won't take credit for this because of the long lag between exposure and diseases like lung cancer. But what I would expect is that with the success that we are seeing, that these reductions will continue and even accelerate over the next decade. So I asked earlier, what have we accomplished? And the answer is a lot. We've changed attitudes. We've changed laws. We've changed social norms, behaviors, smoking rates, and even health outcomes. Continued burden. A significant burden remains. There are still 2.4 million adult smokers in New York. 330,000 of them are those 18 to 24-year-olds. 100,000 high school-age youth smoked a cigarette in the last 30 days. 4% of them are frequent smokers and are likely to become adult smokers. Just FYI, that number used to be 13% back in 2000. That's also a significant reduction. The economic costs associated with tobacco use in New York are staggering, $8.2 billion per year. On overall health care, 2.7 are Medicaid costs borne by the state, and there's another $6 billion on lost productivity that I did not put up here. Next slide, trends in smoking by demographic groups. Our success has not reached everyone. As noted in the chronic disease slide I showed earlier, certain groups have actually benefited very little. This chart shows adults by various demographics and the amount of benefit or change in smoking rates between 2003-2004 and later on 2009-2010. And I'll just to summarize, anything with a bold font means that there was a significant reduction. Those that aren't bold have had non-significant changes. Next slide, disparate groups. Let's see, there we go. Our disparate groups are primarily those with low incomes, low educational attainment, and those who report mental health issues. And we really need to do more to help these groups, and we plan to. I just want to talk briefly about the New York State Department of Health Prevention Agenda for 2013 to 2017. The Prevention Agenda is the blueprint for the state for state and local action to improve the health of New Yorkers in five priority areas and to reduce the health disparities that we were just talking about. I've provided the web address. I haven't provided the web address on this slide. I don't know where it went. It disappeared. We can get that to you later. There are five action plan areas in the prevention agenda, and tobacco control shows up in two of them. The first, of course, is preventing chronic disease, in which there are three goals: prevent initiation, promote cessation, eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke. The second area is in reducing tobacco use among adults who report poor mental health. What's important, really, about the prevention agenda is that it provides a single framework around which the department organizes its efforts, whether it's working with local health departments, whether we're working with our contractors, or even in setting its own goals. There are performance indicators for each goal, and progress will be monitored and reported over time. This is, I think, an important step forward in accountability for the state health department and its partners. And we're skipping this slide. And this one, let's go to the health systems change slide and the analogy of the mole. Let's talk now about tobacco dependence treatment. And I want to start with what I'm calling it's kind of an analogous situation. I'd like to think that if I go to my primary care provider for my annual physical or my annual sinus infection, and he or she saw on the back of my neck a scary-looking mole, like the one pictured here, that a series of events would happen, and to me, the patient, they would almost appear automatic, that there would be an immediate question to me if I knew about it or not. There would probably be a referral to a specialist to examine it, another referral to a lab to test it, and an appointment for a follow-up visit to make sure all this happened, to discuss the outcome, and if necessary, consider treatment options. The knowledge of the mole being there would trigger a series of events that could only be described as aggressive treatment or addressed in an aggressive manner. Well, knowing that a person is a smoker, in my eyes, should receive the same level of aggressive care. Inquiries about my history of tobacco use and earlier attempts to quit, my current level of addiction, my understanding of the risks, and the degree to which I believe those risks apply or don't apply to me, something we call the optimism bias, counseling, prescriptions, referrals, and follow-up, just as was done for the mole. The provider is sending the same message that stopping tobacco use, that treating that mole is the goal, and he or she is here to help you do that. I assume I'm preaching to the converted, but that's okay. This is our goal, to have all providers aggressively, immediately, and repeatedly treat nicotine addiction. The tobacco control program, through its contractors and through discussions, I'm going to get into more detail about the treatment itself, but I just wanted to quickly review the Public Health Service guidelines on treating tobacco use and dependence. That are listed in the 2000 guidelines and then again in the 2008 update. Our goal is to fully integrate tobacco interventions in the delivery of healthcare to ensure that tobacco use is systematically assessed and treated at every clinical encounter. So the five strategies are outlined here is to, again, briefly implement a tobacco use identification system in every clinic, probably through the electronic medical record, to ensure that adequate training, resources, and feedback regarding delivery of effective treatments are available to providers. Having staff dedicated to providing tobacco dependence treatment and assessing treatment delivery and evaluating performance. Promoting hospital policies that support and provide tobacco dependence services. This is mostly done on the inpatient level. Already largely with the help of our cessation centers as a result of their work. And lastly, ensuring the wide availability of effective tobacco dependence treatments, counseling, and approved medications as covered services. Now, how to make this happen will be up to, in large part, our local contractors who are directed to work at the health systems level. Yeah, you're back on track with the slides here. Starting off, you know, I'm not a physician. Let's get that disclaimer out of the way. But what are the particulars of aggressive care, as I talked about earlier? And that depends somewhat on who's being treated. So for the current smoker or tobacco user, we talk about the five A's. The five A's are just a quick mnemonic for remembering the steps involved in aggressive treatment for tobacco dependence. So ASK refers to identifying all tobacco users at every visit. And I would add that we probably should be identifying recent quitters. And probably at this point, we probably have to add nicotine users for those who are using electronic cigarettes. Advise refers to urging all tobacco users to quit strongly. Assess, determine the willingness of the smoker or tobacco user to make a quit attempt. I would add assessing their level of addiction and again, past experience with cessation. Assist refers to providing counseling and medication and perhaps a referral, but we'll talk about that more later. And arrange refers to ensuring follow-up contact. And I would add the expectation that you'll be dealing with relapse at some point. Some reduce these five A's to ask, assist, and refer. To me, they still infers that you need to advise and assess that these things also be done. So the five A's are usually thought of as applying to current smokers who are willing to quit. For the smoker not yet ready to quit, well, we still need to ask, advise, and probably assess. But beyond that, a different type of intervention is really required. This is often defined as motivational interviewing, which is a counseling technique and consists of messages that promote readiness to change. Listed here is the five R's. They include encouraging quitting by providing individually relevant messages. So quitting will help you in your battle to improve your heart disease. Identification and discussion of risks, identification of potential rewards, something we don't always talk about, identifying the roadblocks to quitting, and an understanding on the part of the provider that we're dealing with a very powerful addiction and that repetition will likely be needed. Sorry about the slide there. This slide, assist equals medication, the next these three slides focus on what providing assistance actually refers to. And I see three components. Assist equals medication, it equals counseling, and in some instances it equals referral. So what I've got listed here for medication are the seven FDA-approved over-the-counter and prescription medications for tobacco dependence, all recommended in the Public Health Service guidelines. All seven, of course, have specific contraindications, warnings, precautions, side effects, and other concerns, which are outlined in the Public Health Service Quick Guide, which I will be showing you how to access shortly if you don't already have it. It was also suggested that I remind everyone that recommending these medications to anyone under the age of 18 would be considered off-label activity. There's a couple of second-line medications outlined in the guidelines, clonidine and nortriptyline. But there are certainly many options to try before going that route, including combinations of these seven that are recommended. And it's also important to ensure that the other parts of the assistance are being provided. If NRT isn't working alone, maybe it's because we're not doing the next part, which is the assist equals counseling. As I said, we've already discussed one counseling intervention. That's motivational interviewing, which is really standard procedure in many addiction settings to work with patients who, for one reason or another, are not ready, able, or willing to make quit attempts. There is very good evidence that even brief counseling from a healthcare provider, literally 1 minute to 3 minutes spent discussing tobacco risks and treatment options, is an effective intervention and produces higher than expected quit rates. The evidence is even stronger when brief counseling is combined with nicotine replacement therapy. We know that social support also is important in increasing the likelihood of a successful quit. So encouraging smokers to reach out to family and then friends and include them in the process is very important. The other techniques, the other counseling techniques listed here are less commonly used in practice settings, more likely to show up in academic or hospital settings. And I don't think they're all that critical. Assist equals medication, it equals counseling, and in some instances, referral. Assistance can include a referral to tobacco dependence experts. But then here's my caveat. I would argue that a referral should never be a substitute for immediate and aggressive treatment, provided at the moment the patient and the provider are together in the room. That's a unique and special moment and relationship and should be used to its advantage. So if instead of aggressive care, only a referral is provided, then we're relying solely on the motivation of the smoker, something we know already is very difficult for them to maintain. In this case, having an in-house specialist can be particularly helpful. Referrals to the New York State Smokers Quit Line, 1-866-NY-QUITS, are good as an adjunct to aggressive care, but for the reasons I said above, should not be seen as a substitute. The Quit Line, of course, is the sole source of treatment for many smokers across New York State, and therefore a key component of our comprehensive tobacco control program. But again, that patient-provider relationship is a unique moment in time and should be used wisely. Arranging follow-up visits are important for all the reasons already mentioned. And as I say here, prepare to treat and retreat. Let's talk a little bit about nicotine addiction and what we know. So the withdrawal associated with nicotine dependence is particularly strong and includes both physical and mood-related signs and symptoms, such as strong cravings, anxiety, irritability, restlessness, difficulty concentrating, depressed mood, frustration, anger, increased hunger. It's just a misery of symptoms. Withdrawal symptoms appear quickly, usually within just a few hours of the last nicotine fix, if you will, and are most easily relieved with yet another dose of nicotine, usually very easily available in almost every corner store in the U.S., including New York. Multiple quit attempts are the norm, and the relapse curve for nicotine is pretty much like the relapse curve for every addictive substance used in our culture. If you look at the numbers on this slide, and if you kind of turn them around, subtract 100 from each of them, you see that half to three-quarters of smokers who try to quit relapse within 1 week. And by 3 months, 80 to 90% of smokers who quit have relapsed. Now, most of these smokers who have relapsed have tried to quit on their own. So this is sort of the natural history of smoking and quitting and relapsing. Smoking, and unfortunately, many smokers try to quit on their own. Smoking has been portrayed in the public and by the tobacco industry as a habit, with the implication that relapse from quitting is just a lack of willpower. But we know better, and addiction science tells us that quitting is difficult. Relapse is frustrating for the clinician, but it's potentially deadly for the patient. The challenges slide. And before we look at this, I just want to mention that we have lots of evidence. This is more of a counseling issue. We have lots of evidence that parents who have children living in the house are much less likely to smoke inside the house or to allow others to smoke inside the house. Having children, therefore, probably provides a lever that providers can use as an opening to treat parents who smoke. In two ways. One, by discussing with them the impact of secondhand smoke on their child's health, potential impact, and two, how their own tobacco use affects the likelihood that their child will become a smoker themselves. In a similar way, pregnant women who smoke, pregnancy is an excellent time to intervene for very much the same reasons. Talking about other tobacco products that are out there and are becoming an issue for us. include the smokeless products and water pipes, also known as hookah, are becoming more popular with youth. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that smokeless tobacco is likely more widely used in rural areas, and hookah is becoming especially popular in urban areas and around college campuses. One study I'm aware of showed that the intake of nicotine in a hookah bar was much higher than that consumed when smoking a cigarette. So the potential for addiction is extremely high. And then cross addictions are easy. So these are the challenges for the tobacco control program moving forward, but they also are challenges for the provider who wants to know, you know, the entire breadth of tobacco use in your patients. Let's talk about one non-tobacco nicotine product, electronic cigarettes. I have Boone or Bane. And I would add maybe Boone, Bane, or nothing. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong slide. Yeah, am I on the right slide? Wrong slide. These are old slides, Ann. Anyway, electronic cigarettes are making a splash, and there are strong arguments for and against these devices. Now, most people who argue for more widespread availability and fewer regulations say that electronic cigarettes are much safer to use than tobacco cigarettes or combusted tobacco. And whether used as a cessation device or just as a replacement for tobacco cigarettes, I have to agree that the constituents in e-cigarettes would very likely make them much safer than regular tobacco cigarettes. So again, I agree that e-cigarettes are probably safer than regular cigarettes, but only if they actually replace the tobacco cigarettes. And so there are two issues here to deal with. We really don't know how these products are being used by smokers. It's possible that smokers will use e-cigarettes in places where they can't smoke tobacco and just go back to their regular cigarettes when they can. In this case, e-cigarettes could actually strengthen their addiction to nicotine with absolutely no benefit. But more importantly, there's a much larger potential for harm to the population if youth and young adults use e-cigarettes, become addicted to the nicotine, and then switch and take up tobacco as their preferred nicotine source. And this is a highly likely scenario. It's not out of the realm of possibility. We could potentially lose all the gains that we've made in reducing youth smoking in this state. Recently, the CDC released a report showing that high school age youth use of e-cigarettes doubled in just the past year. The numbers are small, but because of this disturbing trend, I believe that the potential for harm to the population by creating a new generation of youth smokers trumps any potential benefit as a cessation device for current smokers. I know a lot of people don't agree with me on that, but from the population perspective, the harm reduction view needs to take the broadest possible perspective. And again, the potential for harm outweighs the benefit at this point in time. I'm not going to talk about those other things on the slide because I wasn't supposed to. So I'm going to move to the reference slide. That's basically my broad overview of tobacco control in New York State with some additional emphasis on the role of health systems. This slide shows two links with references to the two public health service guides that I referred to earlier. The first is the quick guide, which makes a really useful desk reference. The second provides all the research background, results of meta-analyses for the various treatment options, also very useful. And you can get them PDF or they'll mail you a hard copy either way. With that, I'll say thank you, and shortly I'll be happy to take some questions. But I think first we'll be hearing from Pat Bax, who is our marketing coordinator at the New York State Smokers Quitline.
Thank you, Dr. Jester. Thanks for your enlightening and informative presentation and also for promoting our Quitline services. I'd like to welcome our participants, new and our returning participants, to the call today. For those who may not be familiar with our Quitline services, Dr. Jester did give you a little preview, but we are located at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, and we do provide the free, confidential, and evidence-based cessation services that Dr. Jester mentioned. Our cessation assistance and resources are available for all of New York State residents. And we do receive calls from both tobacco users and other than tobacco users. So any tobacco user can call the Quitline directly. Their provider, their employer, friend, or family might give them a card or a brochure with our number on it. They can register for nicotine replacement therapy online, or they can be referred by their provider. And we do offer free coaching. We use motivational interviewing. Our coaches are trained in those techniques. And we have nicotine replacement patches, a starter kit, motivational support, and a wide array of resources, as you can see, on our website that are all available for download, and a free online community and our messaging service. So for our providers and our employers, we do have a referral service, which includes our Opt-to-Quit program, which is a system-wide adoption of a policy for referring all tobacco users to the Quitline unless they opt out, and that's also available for healthcare facilities. In addition, we have available download materials located under the Health Provider and Partner section at nysmokefree.com, and those do include our fact sheets, our chronic disease fact sheets, secondhand smoke fact sheets, and others. In relation to our topic today, I encourage you to review our annual report for 2012 located on our website under the Provider and Partner section subtab of reports. Our report highlights our history, our services, our characteristics of our Quitline clients who are using our services, and our outcomes. Between 9 and 10% of our Quitline call volume is from tobacco users who are under the age of 24. And if we break this down even further, less than 1% of calls to the Quitline are from participants that are who are under the age of 18. Although we don't offer nicotine replacement therapy to our clients under the age of 18, we still can provide coaching and support, and we have a young adult-specific break-loose downloadable guide that's located under our Guides and Materials section on our website. If you would like more information, as Dr. Jester said, you can call us at 1-866-697-8487. And a gentle reminder to please keep us in mind for your cessation needs as you plan your activities for the Great American Smokeout, which this year is on November 21st. So let us help you to make this event in your area be a huge success in helping tobacco users to quit and stay quit. Thank you for participating on our call today and for helping your tobacco-using patients to become and stay tobacco-free. At this time, Wes, we will open it up for questions.
Certainly, the floor is now open for your questions. If you have a question or comment, please press 7 or Q on your telephone keypad.
I do have a couple of questions that were sent in.
Again, a reminder for a question or comment, please press 7 or Q on your telephone keypad.
Wes, can you hear me? 7. Wes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're unmuted.
Yeah, this is Harlan. I do have a couple of questions that were sent in that I'd like to try and address. Please do say something about NRT packaging. Is NRT going to be made available in smaller units, not just packages of 14 or more? There's a lot of background here, and I won't go into it, but the State Health Department under Dr. Daines did send a letter, a petition to the FDA asking them to consider repackaging NRT in smaller units, like daily units, in pretty much the same way cigarettes are packaged, and also to have them be able to be sold wherever tobacco is sold. The response came a couple months ago and was actually quite favorable. Where it goes from there, I'm not sure, because it's an industry issue. The companies that make this stuff need to get out ahead of this, and To be honest, I'm not sure if we have followed up on that, but the FDA has approved the idea of repackaging NRT and selling it where tobacco products are sold. So something to keep an eye out for the future. You know, that way, instead of having to lay out $50 for NRT and only $8 for a pack of cigarettes or $10 for a pack of cigarettes, the pricing will be much more similar and support the idea of quitting much better. So I don't have the answer, but I think that should be moving along. Leon wanted me to talk a little bit about the private insurance realm. And, of course, the world is changing. You know, the Affordable Care Act is changing everything everything we do in this area. And to be honest, it's extraordinarily complicated, and I don't have a lot of information to answer on that. I know that tobacco dependence treatment is a required covered treatment because it's in the U.S. Prevention Task Force criteria, and it will be part of Affordable Care Act and the health benefit exchange programs. We just started a process in which we are going through, I think there's 18 different 18 different insurance companies that are in the exchange and providing levels of tobacco dependence treatment. We are just starting to review that information and to better understand it ourselves. But it's all this is happening very quickly. We weren't given much information in advance of this, so we're trying to play catch up a little bit and find out what is going on in the commercial area of insurance. So those are the two questions I have. There's one other: lozenges are now covered by Medicaid. I don't know that, so I don't know the answer to that. And are there other questions?
First question comes from Josephine. Josephine, the floor is yours.
I was wondering if you can comment on the use of electronic cigarettes. We run a rather comprehensive smoking cessation program here, and I notice the patients are asking more and more about the electronic cigarettes, and they're using them. They claim that they can buy them without the presence of nicotine. I don't see any sense in using it if it doesn't have the nicotine in it, but they say they do it for the flavors. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I guess there are different levels of nicotine, and I think you, in electronic cigarettes, I guess you buy a cartridge, it can have different flavors, different levels of nicotine, including, I guess, 0 milligrams of nicotine. We don't know if that's a useful cessation tool or not. Regardless, I still stick with my original idea that it sends the wrong message to be walking around puffing on things that look an awful lot like tobacco cigarettes. And we have nicotine replacement, FDA-approved nicotine replacement therapies that we know are helpful. And at this point, I wouldn't support that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Next question comes from Seon. Seon, the floor is yours.
Yes. Hi, Harlan. Thank you so much for answering the question. I just wanted to make a couple comments. Your presentation was excellent. Just to your point, I was just about the daily patches or whatnot, NRT. I'm just going to say that recently, I'm from the New York City Health Department, and recently we kind of surveyed a lot of pharmacies and et cetera, and we found some that did sell 7 days of patches and 20 packs of gum, which were, fairly cheaper than the 14 packs of patches and 110 pieces of gum. So they were a little more affordable and closer to that kind of like daily or one patch type of thing that I know we agreed with you all and Danes with. Another thing, just wanted to confirm, lozenges are not covered by Medicaid fee-for-service. Some Medicaid commercial or managed care plans do cover lozenges, but you have to look independently at those. But I just confirmed that again last week with them because I was running them something by the Medicaid group by, at the state. And then I was just going to echo that we're also doing that process looking through the exchange plans, so we might want to talk offline and coordinate.
That's a great idea. Because I'm sure there's a lot of people doing the same thing, and we should combine our efforts and save time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sam.
No problem.
Next question comes from Jason. Jason, the floor is yours.
Oh, that's you, Dominic.
Yeah. I was just curious on your input on the recent New York City vote for changing the minimum smoking age and how that may have implications for the state as a whole.
Well, if you're asking me what is the state legislature going to do, I have no clue. I think there probably is some support for raising the age statewide. I haven't seen any proposals come across my desk and or heard about any, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens in the near future. I think it's a good policy to have. I really have come to realize that, you know, not all policies are created equal. Not all are equally don't all have the same impact. And I think the 21-year-old smoking is a good one. I don't think it's the strongest thing we could have done, but in terms of age, I think it is good. And so I'm for that. Anything that makes it creates an additional hassle to purchasing tobacco and makes it harder for youth to get to is a good thing. So, but as far as what the state's doing, I don't know. Haven't seen anything yet. Anything else?
Again, as a reminder, for a question or comment, please press 7 or Q on your telephone keypad. This time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Wes. This is Ann Wendland again. I have actually lost my internet connection, so I cannot post the links for the evaluation for you to complete that by clicking on a link in the chat box. You can access the evaluation forms by going to the New York State Smokers Quit Line, the collaborative call page, and you will see along the left-hand side a link for the evaluation form. Then you'll need to complete the evaluation form in order to receive continuing education credits. Our next webinar will be on Wednesday, January 8th at 12 p.m. The topic will be substance use and tobacco. On behalf of the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control, the Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I want to express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today and thank all of you who participated in today's call. This will bring us to an end. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's teleconference. We appreciate your participation. You may now disconnect your line at this time.